Today is December the 12th, 2018.
Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of All Things Computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. At the start of the new year, 2019, the Personal Computer Show will be reformatted to be oriented to internet broadcasting. The cord cutting of the past few years have shown a shift in listeners and viewers from tuning into traditional media platforms to receiving their content on demand when it is convenient for them. We are not ending the show, just the over-air broadcast. The program will continue to be available on PRN.FM on the internet as it is presently scheduled on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the programs will continue to be available from PRN.FM or the major podcast hosting sites, as well as our website, PCRadioshow.org. In this new format, we can continue to be heard regularly every week. The on-air radio program broadcasting from WBAI-FM 99.5 New York has been subjected to so many unannounced preemptions that many listeners don't know if we're on or if we're off. Indeed, some major sites such as The Well in Silicon Valley have prematurely announced our demise earlier in the year. We will go back to our roots in which you, the listening audience, are part of the program. WBAI has not had a telephone system for our listeners to call since we moved out of the Wall Street studios in 2012 in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. If you send us your question or a brief description of what you want to discuss via email, along with your telephone number and a convenient time at which we can reach you, we will call you and record the call for broadcast during the show. If you have any questions or comments for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. Just remember, there's no such thing as a stupid question. The conversation will be recorded to be part of the show, but if you are bashful or shy or just want to remain anonymous, it's no problem. We'll just use the context of what is on your mind and attribute it to a query received in our mailbag, without identifying who wrote us the email. And if you prefer, we do have associates on the air with their feature segments. If you want them to answer your question, we can make arrangements for that too. You, the listening audience, are not the product for the Personal Computer Show, but are an integral part of the show. Just as personal computing has morphed into different supporting platforms since we first broadcast live in 1983, broadcasting on local radio stations has morphed into worldwide podcasting. We hope you will join us in this exciting new adventure and format. Send email to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and let's talk about your computing problems, or, better yet, whatever questions or opinions you have about computing. A Chinese court ordered Apple to stop selling older iPhone models in the country after finding it infringed on two Qualcomm patents. Apple faces ban on sale of older iPhones in China. Qualcomm says a Chinese court ruled that Apple is infringing on two of its patents. The iPhone may have hit a roadblock in China as Apple continues its legal fight with Qualcomm. Strange. Qualcomm Incorporated is an American multinational semiconductor company and telecommunications and equipment manufacturer that designs and markets wireless telecommunications products and services. The company headquarters is located in San Diego, California, and it has 224 worldwide locations. Apple is an American multinational technology company headquartered in Cupertino, California, that designs, develops, and sells consumer electronics, computer software, and online services. Why then are two American companies suing each other in China? A better question is, who cares? If you are an iPhone user, you want to know how this impacts future designs of iPhones. With the dispute, Samsung, already the largest cell phone manufacturer, will only benefit with increase in market dominance. In my opinion, Neither side can claim the higher moral road of business ethics. First, let's say that it's all about money. Why is this being litigated in China? In any lawsuit, you try to select a venue that may be most friendly to you. There is a basic component part in the iPhone 6S, iPhone 6S Plus, iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, and the iPhone 10 covered by two Qualcomm patents. There was an agreement that there would be a rebate on the part if Apple did not use a chip from any other competitor. To date, Apple has received $1.2 billion from Qualcomm on this rebate. However, Qualcomm has been hit with a $1.25 billion fine by antitrust regulators in Europe after an investigation concluded it paid Apple to use its chips over those from competitors. Since then, Apple disputed Qualcomm's legal right to charge heightened royalties for the use of its tech. And Qualcomm's requirement that Apple pay a percentage of the iPhone revenue in return for the use of Qualcomm patents. Since then, Apple disputed Qualcomm's legal right to charge heightened royalties for its tech. And Qualcomm's requirement that Apple pay a percentage of the iPhone's revenue in return for the use of the Qualcomm patents. And Apple has sued the company in three countries. Apple also sued Qualcomm for $1 billion in rebates that were expected to have been paid. China grants Qualcomm preliminary injunction against Apple. The immediate People's Court of China has granted Qualcomm a request for two preliminary injunctions against four of Apple's Chinese subsidiaries. The action had been taken as a result of Qualcomm's claims that technology found infringes on two of Qualcomm's patents. This comes after the Chinese Patent Office found the patents to be valid. Qualcomm asked U.S. trade regulators to ban iPhone imports. Chinese court upholds Qualcomm's complaint that Apple infringed on two patents. A date has been set for a courtroom battle between Apple and Qualcomm in San Diego in April, one set to resolve some of the ongoing patents and royalty lawsuits between the two companies around the world. But while the possibility of a settlement has been raised in a recent Qualcomm interview, Apple's legal team insists that this is not the case at all. By the way, this whole matter is about royalty payment on a part that is worth $18 each. Apple is claiming Qualcomm has imposed unfair licensing terms on smartphone makers. Apple countersued Qualcomm for patent infringement, and Qualcomm hits back. As others who have incorporated the Qualcomm chip, they did not get a rebate, so Apple is paying less and has the advantage of a low cost already competing with others, and yet they're complaining that it's too much. The latest iPhone models introduced this year does not include the Qualcomm chip. These models are essentially lowering the cost for Apple by using Intel chips, which Qualcomm accuses Apple of giving chip secrets to Intel. In the most recent episode in the Liga saga, Qualcomm has accused Apple of stealing valuable trade secrets and giving them to Intel to boost the performance of Intel chips on iPhones. Qualcomm, in the dispute, has held back $1 billion in rebate to Apple. While this dispute drags on, the second largest cell phone manufacturer is just biding its time. Who's that? It's Huawei. Who is Huawei? What's all the fuss with Huawei? Huawei is a leading global provider of information and communications technology, infrastructure, and smart devices. The company is the largest telecommunications equipment maker in the world, having overtaken Ericsson back in 2012. Of course, that's not just due to its smartphone business. The company also makes equipment for corporation telecommunication companies. Huawei Tech Limited is a multinational networking and telecommunications equipment company based out of China. Last week, there was the arrest of a top Huawei executive who is also deputy chairman of the board and the daughter of the Huawei founder. The daughter was changing flights in Canada when she was detained on behalf of the United States of America to face unspecified charges in New York. Huawei and ZTE technology will largely be banned from use by the U.S. government and government contractors. The Pentagon bans Huawei and ZTE phones from retail stores on military bases. The Pentagon is ordering retail outlets on U.S. military bases to stop selling Huawei and ZTE phones, and the Department of Defense says using the devices could be a security risk. A Pentagon spokesman said Huawei and ZTE devices may pose an unacceptable risk to the department's personnel, information, and mission. In light of this information, it was not prudent for the department exchanges to continue selling them. U.S. military members can still buy Huawei and ZTE devices for personal use from other stores, as there's no outright ban on that for now. But the spokesperson elaborated that the Pentagon is considering whether it should send out a military-wide advisory about the devices. Huawei responded with the following statement. Huawei products are sold in 170 countries worldwide and meet the highest standards of security, privacy, and engineering in every country we operate globally, including the United States. We remain committed to openness and transparency in everything we do, and want to be clear that no government has ever asked us to compromise the security or integrity of any of our networks or devices. The Chinese smartphone maker said it was an employee-owned company that would continue to expand globally. U.S. government officials have said that China could order its manufacturers to create backdoors for spying in their devices, although both Huawei and ZTE have denied the possibility. An anonymous source told the Wall Street Journal that military leaders are wary that Beijing could use ZTE and Huawei devices to locate soldiers' exact coordinates and track their movements. Huawei was banned from bidding for U.S. government contracts. In a Senate testimony, six major U.S. intelligence heads warned that American citizens shouldn't use Huawei and ZTE products and services. For a separate reason, the U.S. Department of Commerce banned U.S. exports to ZTE after the company failed to meet a plea agreement when it pleaded guilty to illegally shipping U.S. equipment to North Korea and Iran. ZTE is appealing the ban. Anonymous sources told the Wall Street Journal that the Justice Department is now probing Huawei for possibly violating sanctions against Iran. So the concern with Huawei is basically that they have or may have shipped equipment to Iran and North Korea. And that's a big concern, and it's not a total ban of the public from buying Huawei and ZTE devices, but the military is banned from buying any part of it.
Big Tech Facebook and Google is using misdirection in dealing with the public. A successful magician excels at misdirection. And what is misdirection? In theatrical magic, misdirection is a form of deception in which the performer draws the audience's attention to one thing to distract it from another. Whether the magic is of a pocket trick variety or a large stage production, misdirection is the central secret. Let's look at the computer headline news. Google CEO backs privacy law, denies bias in remarks to Congress. Another headline is, Facebook used people's data to favor certain partners and punish rivals. Google and Facebook are on the hot seat for a collection of personal data. Facebook collects personal data by scanning message content, and it is made available to select advertisers. In the case of Google, it's more than message content. It's also location tracking. Facebook owns Onavo, which is a VPN service. You think a VPN service would provide user with anonymity? Think twice before using that as a VPN. Reuters reported Facebook let some companies, which included Netflix and Airbnb, access users' lists of friends after it cut off that data for most others. And according to documents released by a British lawmaker that investigated fake news and social media, this is what he discovered. Facebook says the facts are clear. We never sold people's data. They only make data available to their advertisers, Extending this line of reasoning, we can only conclude that if they are not advertisers, the data is not available. Let's be clear. What they are doing is not illegal. They are not a part of any government organization. You always hear people refer to the First Amendment regarding free speech. The First Amendment applies only to the government. Google directly doesn't sell your data to some third party, but uses the data collected on you for its own purpose of creating targeted ads, to which it in turn is nothing but indirectly selling your data to companies who pay Google to advertise their products and or services. They are also downplaying their proposed plans to bring a search engine back to China. We are focusing on how the data is being sold and used. We should be addressing a much larger issue, and that is why they are permitted to gather personal data without user permission in the first place. If you don't have the data, there's no issue with privacy. Would this intrusion on your personal life, will it ever cease? The basic answer is no. The biggest culprit is the government. The collection of private data by the government is enormous. Google Chief Executive Officer Sundar Pichai backed privacy legislation and denied the company is politically biased. He said, "I lead this company without political bias and work to ensure that our products continue to operate that way. To do otherwise would go against our core principles and our business interests." What is actually done, at least in perception to the public, is contrary to what he said. He also described user privacy as an essential part of their mission, while stressing Google's U.S. roots. As an American company, we cherish the values and freedoms that have allowed us to grow and serve so many users. He said, "I am proud to say we do work and we will continue to work with the government to keep our country safe and secure." Pichai has been testifying before the House Judiciary Committee hearing about the company's data collection, search business, and a range of other issues. Alphabet Inc., which is Google's parent company, proposed a framework for federal privacy legislation early this year. The remarks did not directly address Google's retreat from a U.S. Department of Defense contract or its proposed plan to bring a search engine back to China, two subjects that will likely come up during the current hearings. Not all big tech is doing things under the radar and you don't know about it. Microsoft is asking for government regulation on their facial recognition technology. Instead of implementing new technology that most probably will impact privacy and security, Microsoft is doing something different. It's asking the government to regulate the company's facial recognition tech. This is a very refreshing approach. Microsoft sent one of its top executives to Washington with an unusual request to ask the government to regulate the use of the company's automated facial recognition software. In fact, Microsoft President Brad Smith called for a conversation about appropriate rules and suggested that a new law should be put in place now. The world needs to have confidence that this technology will be used well. Then we'll be able to innovate in ways that benefit society. But if nothing happens and facial recognition remains a rules-free space, commercial pressure will push companies to choose between being societally responsible and gaining a market share. If left unchecked, could allow governments to crack down on dissidents, be used as a form of mass surveillance, and when inaccurate, wrongly identify innocent citizens as criminals. Smith outlined a few key planks of Microsoft's desired regulatory framework over automated systems that identify people via their facial characteristics. Transparency constitutes the first big plank. Companies offering facial recognition services should clearly document how they work and when they can fall short, and they should allow independent testing of the accuracy of these systems by third parties via web interfaces. Microsoft also wants to stop facial recognition from reinforcing existing discriminatory patterns. It would require companies to provide for human review of decisions that would affect a person's privacy or freedom or subject them to possible harm, and ban the use of facial recognition services for illegal discrimination. The idea of adequate notice plays another big part. Places and online services using facial recognition systems to identify customers must post conspicuous notices warning people about that use. In turn, customers continuing through to those places or services after seeing those notices would be regarded as consenting to their facial recognition systems. Finally, the government must get a court order to use facial recognition for any ongoing surveillance of people in public unless death or serious injury is about to result. Smith emphasized that while facial recognition has been a topic of conversation since the 1960s, advances in the development and deployment of connected cameras and cloud-based software to analyze their feeds have been rapidly turning it into a reality. He noted such positive ventures as New Delhi Police use of this technology to trace 3,000 missing children, the recent rollout by Delta of facial recognition authentication throughout the international terminal at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, and Microsoft's app Spoken descriptions of whatever's in front of your phone's camera. Smith said, "The facial recognition genie is just beginning to leave the bottle, and it's time for action." But he added, "Some companies and countries in this space place less value on ethics and transparency. We've turned down deals because we didn't believe that the technology would be used well," he said. "We've turned down deals because we worried that this technology would be used to put people's right at risk." Smith didn't name any of these problematic actors, although since his statement was a response to a question about China's use of facial recognition, there wasn't much room for imagination. There are definitely countries where we are and will not be comfortable providing our artificial intelligence technology to governments. We commend Microsoft for taking such action on openness and use of new technology. Hey, Facebook and Google, please take note of this. Our feature segments this evening is first starting with Dr. Alfred Poor, wearable monitors help emergency responders, followed by AI doctors already at work in England, and he'll finish up with forecast shows strong wearables market growth. I'll be covering whether or not there is a connection with cell phone and cancer. One government agency says yes, another one says no. Hey, Marty? Hey, Marty, what resolutions have you made for the end of the year?
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Modern wearables are miracles. In a tiny form factor that you can strap to your wrist or stick on your chest, they can measure heart rate, breathing rate, your activity levels, temperature, a whole lot of very important biometric measures that can tell you a lot about your health and how your body's doing. But the problem is this is designed for individuals. What if you needed to have information about a lot of people all at the same time? For example, if you're a paramedic or an EMT and you happen upon an accident scene, you might have a handful of victims or you might have dozens of them. And the problem is, who needs the most attention? Who needs to be treated first? Who needs to be taken to the hospital first? The whole diagnosis and triage process becomes very complicated. And wearables could help with this problem, but not traditional wearables like we use as individuals. The U.S. Department of Energy has a Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and they've developed a prototype for a product that they're calling VitalTag. Now, this is a low-cost sensor that you can stick on the chest of a patient, and it will record and report the basic vital sign information about that patient. Now, the interesting thing is that it will transmit this information to a dashboard that can be run on a laptop or a tablet or some other mobile device. And since the wearable also has GPS information, it's able to show the physical location of the patient. So in addition to having the vital sign information, the emergency first responders also get their location so they can see who needs attention most urgently, and they can figure out who needs to be transported first, and they can perform all these triage kinds of operations that are essential in an emergency like this, where time can make the difference between life and death. So this is a really interesting application for wearable technology, and no doubt, if it's adopted, could save lots of lives. I'm sorry that you're not feeling well. The robot doctor will talk to you right now. Now, that sounds like something out of science fiction. We know that artificial intelligence is making great gains, and there's a lot of projects in the labs and things that are in early developmental stage to help support healthcare professionals with artificial intelligence in dealing with patients. But the fact is, there are robot doctors already diagnosing and helping treat patients. If you're in England and you're part of the National Health Service, there's a company called Babylon Health. They have developed an artificial intelligence system called Ask Babylon. With a smartphone or whatever you call up and you speak to this system, it asks about your symptoms, it can interact with the patients, and it can handle the vast majority of healthcare issues that primary care providers will see. And it can even give the patients the next steps to take. Now, of course, if the problem is serious, one of the next steps would be to interact with a human doctor. But the fact is that this provides a first level of support. The thing is, this is not science fiction. This is something that's already in practice. There are 5 clinics that use it, and anybody within 40 minutes of that clinic can use the Ask Babylon application. It's available 24/7. It's always free to the patient, and the National Health Service pays the Babylon Health system just as it would if the patients were talking to a human doctor. So it's a very interesting application of artificial intelligence. It illustrates just how fast we're moving in this area and shows that this kind of a system already is put to practical use to help make healthcare more affordable and more efficient. In the past few weeks, 2 major industry analysis companies have come out with forecasts about the wearables industry. One interesting thing about it is that they're in pretty close agreement about where the market is headed. Gartner is one of the groups that has released a report, and basically they're seeing wearables unit shipments is going to be up almost 25% in 2019 over what they expect to ship in 2018. 25%, a quarter more, is a significant amount of growth. So where is all this growth coming from? Well, 2 areas that they singled out are head-mounted displays and ear-worn devices, primarily hearables. It's not really surprising that these 2 areas are going to see big growth because actually their sales at this point are relatively small. So any increase is going to show up as a high percentage increase. But the real surprise here was the 3rd category that's going to be driving this growth, and that's smartwatches. I was surprised by this because I was beginning to think that the smartwatch market was cooling off. And part of this is due to Apple Watch's slowing sales. But the fact is that there's many different smartwatches out there, many different brands, including a whole lot of low-end models coming out of China. So this is going to be an interesting section that's driving the growth. Another part of the analysis about why smartwatches are increasing in the wearables marketplace is that there are more features getting added to them. So when your smartwatch doesn't cost that much more than a fitness band and does everything your fitness band does, but more, people are going to be interested in buying the more and getting the smartwatch. And so that makes some sense. This is going to be a big part of the growth for the wearables market. Now, one of the other interesting points that they made about the wearables growth is about in-ear devices, ear-worn devices. And they actually predict that by 2022, the ear-worn devices are going to pass the smartwatches in terms of total shipments. Now, some of this is, again, hearables. People are going to take advantage of the much lower cost for hearing aids that we're going to help people with impaired hearing. But the other thing is that ear-worn devices are also going to become wireless personal assistants. Imagine that you can access Siri or Alexa just by talking to it, and a device stuck in your ear will talk back to you and give you the information you need. This is going to eliminate a lot of the functions that we already do with smartphones. And you could ask your ears to give you the information you're looking for. So that's an interesting development to look forward to. IDC is the other company. They're showing a similar positive view on the growth in this market. They're looking at a 21% increase in sales in the third quarter of 2018 compared to the third quarter of 2017. The Japanese market is one of the few where sales are declining, but Chinese market is very strong for entry-level products, and the U.S. market is now strong for the devices that have more features, such as smartwatches. So the wearables market is growing rapidly, shows no sign of slowing, and it looks like we're going to see a lot of good choices for consumers and others in terms of variety of wearables and the kinds of things that they can do for us.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. We tell listeners that not all information on the internet is accurate. For me, if there's any question about a news item or statement, I try to get it verified from more than one source. But what do you do when there's a conflict of information with a research study in which two U.S. government agencies are at odds with each other? One says there's a clear cell phone cancer link, and that is based on a recent study by the National Toxicology Program under the National Institute of Health, showing clear evidence, at least what they say, of a causal link between cancer and exposure to wireless cell phone signals. These are results from a $30 million NTP study demonstrating that cell phone radiation caused Schwann cells cancers of the heart and brain, gliomas in rats, as well as DNA damaged in the brain. That's big news. In the National Institute of Health news release, NTP senior scientists said, "We believe that the link between radio frequency radiation and tumors in male rats is real, and the external experts agree." But amazingly, the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, says it disagrees with this carefully conducted peer review study finding of clear evidence of really ill effects. According to the director of the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health, these findings should not be applied to human cell phone usage. They add that we believe the existing safety limits for cell phones remain acceptable for protecting the public health. While expressing this opinion, Dr. Shurin of the FDA neglects to note that the International Agency for Research Center on Cancer, a part of the World Health Organization, classifies radio frequency radiation from wireless devices as a possible human carcinogen based largely on findings of increased risk of gliomas and Schwann cell tumors in the brain near the ear in humans after long-term use of cell phones. Thus, the same tumor types are elevated in both animals and humans are exposed to cell phone radiation. The FDA's position is quite unusual because it was this agency that nominated cell phone radiation emitted from wireless communication devices to the NTP for studies in experimental animals so as to provide the basis to assess the risk to human health. At that time, the FDA reasoned that existing exposure guidelines are based on protection from acute injury from thermal effects of radio frequency radiation exposure and may not be protective against any non-thermal effects of chronic exposure. By adopting this new position and ignoring the NTP's results, the FDA is clearly shirking its responsibility of assessing the impact on human health of radio frequency radiation. Simply claiming that conclusions about human risk cannot be drawn from animal studies runs counter to standard practices of evaluating human cancer risk by public health agencies. The NTP studies were conducted to test the widely held assumption that cell phone radio frequency radiation could not cause cancer or other adverse health effects because this type of radiation did not have sufficient energy to break chemical bonds. The NTP findings that cell phone radiation caused cancer in the heart and brain, DNA damage in brain cell, heart muscle disease, and reduced birth weights clearly demonstrate that the assumption that non-ionizing radiation cannot cause cancer or other health effects is wrong. This study by the National Health Institute runs counter to the Food and Drug Administration. And what does the public do when there is a difference in the findings or interpretation or an analysis of the information itself? For me, I would probably say I would err on the safety side and say, yes, there may be a potential problem with radio frequency radiation. And I would be more careful in the use of cell phones to make sure that it is not placed close to the ear. An important lesson that should be learned from the NTP studies is that we can no longer assume that any current or future wireless technology, including 5G, is safe without adequate testing.
No one, absolutely no one, is ever even the least little bit late when it's time to decide on their New Year's resolutions, right? Yeah, right. Let's talk about New Year's resolutions. No surprise, I will have some suggestions, but whose idea was this in the first place? Well, it's even older than Hank or Joe. The tradition of making New Year's resolutions is quite ancient, starting millennia ago, with promises made to deities, especially, you'll note, in the darkest times of the year. Later, for the Romans, the practice involved promises to the god Janus, the god of beginnings, of transitions like gates or passages or doorways, the god of time, the god of duality with two faces, one to view the past and the other to view the future. One of the most fascinating things we learned, and what I'm about to cite is based on surveys, not on a more actuarial scope of research, is that about 40% of us now make New Year's resolutions, almost double the percentage of a century ago. About half of us are confident of keeping the resolutions we make, but for every person who really does keep his or her resolution, there are more or less 8 other people who don't. Still, it's better odds than the lottery. I find that among my friends and family, the best likelihood of success comes with the smallest number of resolutions, and there's nothing wrong with making just one if it's one you can keep. So if you haven't yet come up with your resolutions for 2.5 weeks from now, maybe I can offer some examples. Let me start with a few resolutions for my fellow journalists. If the press release says it's the world's most whatever whatever, where the first whatever is an adjective and the second whatever is a noun or noun phrase, resolve to delete on receipt. They may not be lying, they could just be ignorant, but it's certainly not newsworthy. It can't really be the world's most advanced Bluetooth earbud, or the world's most desirable spaghetti fork, or the world's most innovative shoelace nib. Every time we see that kind of headline, it turns out to be the world's most desperate maneuver to get people to spend money backing some lame idea on a crowdfunding site. Resolve to just hit delete, delete on receipt. Here's another. If the call from the PR agency is to book an appointment or interview their client's CEO at a booth during the trade shows, resolve to book the appointment and then don't show up. They're never on time and your time isn't worthless and there's only a limited amount of time for you to see everything else at the show. Now, when you don't show, if they chase you down and try to corral you into coming anyway, make them take you to dinner instead, on them. Remember, there's nothing in any of this that compels you to do a story. Resolve to be a no-show when all they offer is a chance to watch some executive's lips move. Also, for press people, if you have time to walk the aisles at a trade show, resolve not to do it alone. When you show up solo, they may well be very dismissive of you, but when a healthy little herd of press badges all shows up all at once, they don't dare ignore it. resolve to involve the power of more than one. Okay, moving on. For any of you who happen to own a computer, this one should be pretty easy. Resolve to get the old year out of its nooks and crannies. Open it up. Use a bench blower tool, or if you have to, canned air, plus in some cases a vacuum cleaner. Notebook or desktop, every computer has a case, every case breathes, and everywhere the computer breathes, dust collects. Blow it away. Are there removable filters? Clear their mesh. Blow out the fans. Blow out your keyboard. Grab a squeeze bulb and blow out the optical window in your mouse. While you're at it, use a sanitizing wipe on anything you touch. It all takes about 20 minutes tops and can help your computer work more reliably longer. So resolve to clean it out. And let me ask, is it a little harder to see the small print on your PC screen? Try cleaning it. And if that doesn't work, resolve to have your vision checked. Sometimes it's a foot race to see over time which is degrading more, your display or your eyesight. If you get tired earlier than you used to after a few hours at the computer, check both. I've been doing something that may inspire you too. I've been gathering up every manual I can find and all of the documentation I can find for everything. Technology, appliances, power tools, you name it. I bought three things, two small cheap plastic file totes and one set of alphabet tab dividers. All of those manuals go there, filed by the brand name. Not finding the manual, off the table. Not remembering which of several keep places a specific manual might be kept in, off the table. And even when those file folders are full, those totes weigh little enough that you can take them to where the product is. So coming up with the wrong manual is off the table. You don't have to trek to file cabinets and eat up their drawer space, and there's nothing wrong with keeping those totes on a shelf or in a cupboard somewhere because you don't have to get at manuals all that often. And that takes the totes off, or at least not on, the table. Resolve to figure out some cheap and easy way to handle all of your manuals. Here's one that might save you $100 or more next year. Resolve to figure out how much internet bandwidth you really need, even if that exercise has to start with figuring out how much you really use, and if you want, you can even double that. Then compare the number you come up with how much bandwidth you pay for now, and save the money. Cut back to just what you need with a little elbow room. Resolve to check the tread on your tires, and if you need new tires, buy them. Yeah, I know, tires are expensive. Just remember, accidents are a lot more expensive, even if they're just fender benders. Resolve to make that quick tread check so accidents can be a little less likely. Resolve to check. This one might take you an hour. Resolve to check every battery in the house. Some will have leaked. Read up on how to safely handle those and make a very considered decision about whether or not that probably ruined device is important to keep. While you're at it, if the battery has a replacement warranty, check and see if you can get the battery brand to replace that gizmo. You could just swap in new batteries everywhere, but that can get pretty expensive pretty quickly. Battery checkers are fairly inexpensive. Your goal is to only leave batteries in things you really use, to make sure that anything with a battery has one that tests as good, and to at last know what those battery counts add up to, so you don't overbuy replacements. So yeah, resolve to babysit your batteries. Resolve to check your fire extinguishers. Look at any replace by or good through dates. Look at the kinds of fires they're qualified to address, and if you need to, replace or add to them. Make sure everybody in the house knows where they are and how to use them. If any of the kids are too small to handle a fire extinguisher, at least try to teach them how to call 911 in case of an emergency and how to give that operator a complete address. It doesn't take a lot of work to make these minimal fire safety measures an easy-to-keep resolution. Here's one that's really easy. Resolve to tell at least two other people, people who you think might enjoy listening to Hank and Joe and the gang, exactly when and where and how to catch these shows. If they're people you see a lot, it's one way to make sure you'll always have something to talk about. Resolve to get them to listen. Resolve to find 10 things to donate to charity. You go through a lot of tech, right? And you keep a lot of the stuff that you've since replaced, right? That stuff may be useful to somebody else. If you can't find a charity that's interested, ask at a local school. One way or another, resolve to transform your urge to hoard it into helping someone who couldn't otherwise afford it. Resolve to stop complaining about... never mind, that's not likely to happen. Resolve to lock your windows. It closes a common energy leak that otherwise costs you money. Please pay very close attention to this next one. Resolve not to undereat during the holidays, not to cut back or cut down on anything, not to think about calories or fat, not to turn down or dodge second or third helpings, not to hesitate wolfing food down like it's going out of style. And if, like so many of us, you always break at least one resolution, make it this one. Next up, resolve to either do a little more exercise, even walks up and down the street or in the park or around the block, or if you can't resolve to do that, then resolve to update your will. Resolve to spend at least half an hour dark every day, meaning no mobile, no tablet, nothing digital. It's okay to use the time to read a book or a newspaper as long as they're real and printed with ink. Or use the time to exercise or work with tools or clean the house or look at the stars. But do resolve to make it a full 30 minutes with no keyboards and no glowing screens. Resolve to pay attention to what your house is telling you. Are the rooms drafty? Any of them uncomfortable? Do you hear creaking noises at night? Humming in the walls? Do you see icicles on the windows? There may be some easy repairs that long-term will save you money. Resolve to look into them. Meanwhile, back at your computer, resolve to let your antivirus software do at least one deep, full, complete scan. You don't have to stick around. The last time I did one, it lasted 3.5 days, and I'm pleased to announce that it didn't find anything. That turned out to be very important. A few days later, just after that deep scan, I got an email demanding something just under $1,000, claiming they had planted a Trojan to capture my keystrokes and my web browsing, plus all my contacts, and they were going to send videos of me doing nasty things while viewing naughty sites if I didn't pay up. I couldn't help thinking, hey, good luck with that. My nasty and naughty activities tend to involve recording radio segments and falling asleep when I run out of energy while writing. Please, if you bad guys on the dark web have those videos, be my guest. Go ahead and share them. As to recordings of my activities while browsing, I have 6 cameras connected to my PC and each one lights up when it's on, so I know that part couldn't happen, nor would they see anything, because all 6 cameras are set up for Skype calls, so their field of view doesn't go any lower than my elbows. But the clincher, getting back to that malware scan, is that in my case, I could be absolutely sure that no one had planted any kind of Trojan here. How about you? If you can be just as sure of your PC, that could potentially spare you from a $1,000 extortion attempt, among other things. And you could be absolutely, completely, rock-solid confident that there's nothing nasty in the data when you back up, back up, back up your system, which itself is another really good resolution.
Marty, thank you, and I'll give you a final resolution. Control-Alt-Delete. Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Do You Have Medical Questions? And Where Do You Get Reliable Answers? The meeting is held on Thursday, December the 13th, and the time of the meeting is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 411, in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 14th. They meet at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus at Old Westbury, New York. The Brookdale Computer User Group has a presentation on what's new with Chromebooks in 2018. Meeting is Thursday, December the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they hold their meetings at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. If you have any club meetings you want me to announce on your behalf on the air, send me a note. My address is hankkey@pcradioshow.org. We like to hear from you, and if you have any computer-related questions or comments, drop us a line at hankkey@pcradioshow.org. At the start of the new year, 2019, the Personal Computer Show will be reformatted to be oriented to internet broadcasting. The cord cutting of the past few years have shown a shift in listeners and viewers from tuning into traditional media platforms to receiving their content on demand when it is convenient for them. We are not ending the show, just the over-air broadcast. The program will continue to be available on PRN.FM, on the internet as it is presently scheduled on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the programs will continue to be available from PRN.FM or the major podcast hosting sites, as well as our website, PCRadioshow.org. In this new format, we can continue to be heard regularly every week. We will go back to our roots in which you, the listening audience, are part of the program. If you send us your question or brief description of what you want to discuss via email, along with your telephone number and a convenient time at which we can reach you, we will call you and record the call for broadcast during the show. If you have any questions or comments for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. The conversation will be recorded to be part of the show, but if you are bashful or shy or just want to remain anonymous, it's no problem. We'll just use the context of what is on your mind and attribute it to a query received in our mailbag without identifying who wrote us the email. And if you prefer, we do have associates on the air with their feature segments if you want them to answer your question. We can make arrangements for that too. Just as personal computing has morphed into different supporting platforms, broadcasting on local radio stations has morphed into worldwide podcasting. We hope you will join us in this exciting new adventure and format. Send email to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and let's talk about your computing problems, or better yet, whatever questions or opinions you have about computing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on PRN.FM on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And to paraphrase a noted Yuletide song, chestnuts roasting on an open fire. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92, although it's been said many times in many ways, back up, and back up your system. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.